Hey, this is Jeremy. Just wanted to hop on before the episode started with a few announcements. We really want to hear from you, and perhaps the best way to do that, we actually have a subreddit now. It's just r/polyphonicpress, and I'll leave a link to it in the show notes. But it's always been my dream to have a community where we can all get together and talk about the albums that we review and just music in general. So if you want to join the community and start the community, really, because it's quite small right now, it's just r/polyphonicpress. And you can always help out the show in various ways. You can check out our Patreon and get these episodes the day before that they go live, and leave a rating and a review on Apple Music or Spotify or wherever you're listening. Those are great ways to get in touch with us as well. That's it. I just wanted to say that. And now on to the episode. Thank you.
Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is Joni Mitchell, The Hissing of Summer Lawns.
Okay.
All right. So this is will be our second Joni Mitchell album that we've done.
That's right. We did one a while ago.
First started, yeah.
Yeah. Which one was that?
It was called Hijira.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So this is what it says on allmusic.com. It says, Joni Mitchell evolved from the smooth jazz pop of Court and Spark to the radical hissing, of Summer Lawns, an adventurous work that remains among her most difficult records. After opening with the graceful In France They Kiss on Main Street, the album veers sharply into the Jungle Line, an odd Moog-driven piece that backed by the rhythms of the warrior drums of Burundi, a move into multiculturalism that beat the likes of Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel, and Sting to the punch by a decade. While not as prescient, songs like Edith and the Kingpin and Harry's House, Centerpiece, are no less complex or idiosyncratic, employing minor key melodies and richly detailed lyrics to arrive at a strange and beautiful fusion of jazz and shimmering avant-pop. So so it's a short review there, but so this album was released in November of 1975. The genres are jazz pop, folk jazz, art rock, and avant pop, and was released on Asylum Records, and it was produced by Joni Mitchell. And there's 10 songs on the album, and is divided evenly between side one and side two, five and five. So if you're listening along, which we encourage you to do, and I've linked the album in the show notes to both Spotify and Apple, so you can listen to it on your preferred medium. And so what we usually do is we take a pause of halfway through the album. So we'll listen to the first five songs, and it starts In France They Kiss on Main Street. And then we'll take a pause halfway through after the song Shades of Scarlet Conquering. And okay, so here we go. Here is the first song on the album called In France They Kiss on Main Street. Here we go. All right, and ending the first half of the album, the first side, with Shades of Scarlet Conquering. Yeah, very eclectic, this album. Yeah, it's kind of all over the place. But I like it. You know, I always like her. I like her phrasing, her vocal phrasing. She manages to, the way she can fit a lot of syllables into a simple melody. I always, nobody else quite does that like the way she does.
No, it's true. Yeah, she's got a way with words that sort of surpasses a lot of people. Yeah, this is one of her more produced albums, I think. But that's not to say that's a bad thing. This is obviously a vision of hers, and it's a very eclectic mix of things. I thought the Jungle Line was a pretty cool song.
That was very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the drums were actually recorded by the Warrior Drums of Burundi. So it was actually the group of Burundi drummers.
Oh wow.
That recorded that. And I think we talked about Burundi rhythms on the Adam and the Ants
That's right.
episode. And so that's where that came from. And it's these actual, I'm just reading, it's these actual big wooden drums, and these guys with these big, you know, sticks are just pounding these things. And it gives this huge, you know, sound, and it sounds really cool. And yeah. Yeah, I like that song. I like the way that the rhythm played off of the Moog synthesizer. It was very weird, but it was very cool at the same time.
Yeah, no, yeah. That one I think is the one that really appealed to me, just because it was so different. Like the use of, you know, Burundi drummers and a Moog synthesizer together is not something you would ever expect anybody to do, but
not really. No,
no, it was just it's a very original idea. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah. She's it's funny, like the album that we reviewed before, Hijira, is the follow-up to this one. So this one came out a year before that one. And apparently, like, initially the reception on this album was, like, it was not well-received. So this is what it says. This is an excerpt from the Wikipedia article on this album. It says, the album initially received harsh criticism. In Rolling Stone, Stephen Holden wrote that the album's lyrics were impressive, but the music was a failure. If the hissing of summer lawns offers substantial literature, this is a quote from the article, if the hissing of summer lawns offers substantial literature, it is set to insubstantial music. Four members of Tom Scott's L.A. Express are featured on Hissing, but their uninspired jazz rock style completely opposes Mitchell's romantic style. The Hissing of Summer Lawns is ultimately a great collection of pop poems with a distracting soundtrack. Read it first, then play it. And then another one, critic Robert Christgau called the musical accompaniment of the most ambitious of her career, but criticized Mitchell's choice of session musicians and opined that, quote, only a couple of cuts, the Jungle Line and Don't Interrupt the Sorrow, do these skillful sound effects strengthen the lyrics. The result is that Mitchell's words must stand pretty much on their own. I disagree with that completely.
Yeah, I don't think that's quite right. I agree that the Jungle Line was one of those songs that the sounds, like, actually, you know, really helps those lyrics along.
Yeah.
I thought they did that actually very well on that song.
Yeah. And the other ones too. I mean, in France, They Kiss on Main Street, that's probably the most radio friendly song so far. It was her last top 10 hit that she ever had. But I thought the other songs, like, I was paying more attention to her voice. Like, the Jungle Line the music is what drew my attention on that song. The other songs, her vocals are mostly what I was paying attention to. So it's kind of the opposite to what that guy was saying. It's I find that the music is accompanying her vocals really well, and it kind of makes you pay attention to them rather than distracting from them. And so, like, I don't know what they were listening to or what they were hearing, but it does say that the record's reputation has grown in stature over the years. Music writer Howard Sounds has called The Hissing of Summer Lawns Mitchell's masterpiece, an LP to stand alongside Blood on the Tracks. Prince, a lifelong fan of Mitchell, praised it in interviews. He reportedly called it the last album I loved all the way through. So it does have, I think, like, I guess this album and then the follow-up, Hegira, she was going down that road of more jazz influence, more, I don't quite know what to call it. Like a softer sort of ensemble. Cause I remember on the Hegira album, Jaco Pastorius, who's famous for inventing the fretless bass, was the bass player on that album. And that was really one of the first albums to feature a fretless bass, which is, you know, something you would hear on, you know, this like folk music all over the place in the '80s. And so she was kind of going down that road anyway. And so maybe it was just a shock to people to hear her going this direction, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, the marriage of folk and jazz in the 70s, I think, did shock a lot of people.
Yeah.
And they weren't ready for it until the 80s sort of rolled around. And yes, and, you know, the folk festival I attend pretty much every year. Yeah, you hear people show up with things like fretless basses and that, and it's a real mix of different genres and everything that sort of falls under a folk envelope, I guess.
Yeah.
But jazz is not. It's really interesting. Like, its ties to the blues should you know, put it under like a folk music.
Mm-hmm.
Umbrella.
Yeah.
But I guess people weren't, I guess, I don't know, people look at folk music as, it can be very sophisticated, but I don't think a lot of people see it that way. Whereas jazz, people look at it as being very sophisticated, but it's also.
I suppose so. I guess, because folk music by definition is for the people, and I guess in a way it's supposed to be simple so that, you know, even people who aren't musicians or musically inclined can sing along with it. You know, think Woody Guthrie, it's just him and a guitar, strumming guitar, chords on a guitar. And the point of it is I've written this song. I've got something to say about what's going on in the world. And this is my message. And here's the song. And when I leave here, you can sing the song and spread the message. That's really the point, or initially what the point of folk music was. And then the point of jazz was to dance. It was like, it's almost like rock versus EDM, you know, it's almost the same sort of. The two worlds are sort of similar. Jazz was being played in the clubs, and it was to dance, and then folk was, you know, something else. And so I guess in the 70s, yeah, I guess was it the 70s when, well, I guess it must have been Joni Mitchell marrying the two together, because I guess Dylan going electric, that was rock and folk. And so that had been done with, you know, like the Birds and the Band, and but I don't know if jazz had entered the picture until Joni Mitchell came along.
I guess you can look back to more commercial forms of jazz when, even people like Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald and people like that had they sort of presented a little bit more of a pop orientation to the jazz world, and you can almost see that as like the because pop and folk are very, they're a lot more alike than a lot of people realize. But folk is a little more underground. Pop is obviously pop. It's pop culture. It's at the forefront. But this might have been around period when folk on its own was sort of experimenting a little bit. But you saw that a little bit in the 60s too with the hippie culture and whatnot. Like there's a lot of folk musicians. But I guess they didn't touch on jazz, but they were definitely experimenting with all sorts of other things. But I guess jazz came along in the folk world probably in around the 1970s. So yeah, I'd say that was probably accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating because, yeah, you're right. Like going to that folk festival, like it's just like, well, yeah, jazz is part of it, you know, or jazz inspired stuff is part of it at least, you know. But yeah, I guess we'll get on with the rest of the album. And so side two starts with the title track, The Hissing of Summer Lawns. So here we go. All right, and ending the album with Shadows and Light. Yeah, this is a very fascinating album. It's very eclectic, but still works as an album. Yeah, I'm really, you know, I can't see a bad thing about it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I was actually really getting into the second half of it. I thought it was, yeah, the Hissing of Summer Lawns is a really good song. Again, it was a little more radio friendly, but I think it was better than the first, In France, the Kiss on Main Street. I think it was a better song. Harry's House Centerpiece, where it really showcased jazz. That was quite a piece. Shadows and Light was very, very, that was impressive. That song was actually very clever. And I thought it was, instead of losing my words.
I think that one was just her.
And a synthesizer.
And the synthesizer with like the vocals, she was harmonizing, like recording herself. The vocals with herself. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. That was really fascinating too. I mean, I like that. Yeah, I mean, I think she has this ability to create music that it's very distinctly her. Like you can always, she has a very distinct, the timbre of her voice, yes, but her vocal, like I said, the vocal phrasing is very unique to her. Like the way she writes melodies and the syllables, and like I said, was saying before, like it's very, I don't know anybody else who quite has that approach, and that's very uniquely her. It's really interesting, and you know the other session players on this are really good too. It's weird that it was not well received when it was first released, but
it's definitely a better album than what people considered at the time. I think it just was a shock to the system.
Yeah.
When it comes to listening to people like Joni Mitchell, they were expecting a little bit more like singer-songwriter, acoustic guitar kind of approach, and this is just not that.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And well, and I like it when, like, I guess I understand the fan expecting something and not getting it, but also as an artist, you want to expand and do different things too. You can't get stuck doing the same thing. I mean, you know, every artist evolves and does different things and tries new things.
I mean, Joni Mitchell can't write Blue over and over again.
No, exactly.
Because it would take away from Blue.
Right, exactly. And you know, if you think about, I always heard the analogy is an album is really a snapshot of the artist of what they were going through or what was happening at the time in their lives.
Yeah.
And so yeah, if she's like, if people became a fan of her when Blue came out, which was what, 71 or 72,
something like that. Yeah.
If she's, you know, 3 or 4 years later, that was then. And, you know, she's moved on from that. And yeah, you can't expect the same thing from artists. And, you know, they gotta do new and interesting things. Otherwise, you know, I know that, you know, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you get bored. You know, you want to do new things, and sometimes the fans like it and sometimes the fans really hate it.
They do. I don't know if they really hated this album, but they definitely were sort of taken aback and said, this wasn't it.
Yeah. I mean, in general, I mean,
yeah, I know,
you know, yeah,
but oh yeah. Sometimes fans really hate something. No, I think this album definitely deserved better than it got when it came out. And I'm glad it gets a little bit more respect now as it deserves. But I can't, again, this song or this album has, most of the songs on this one are not ones that people reference when they go back to Joni Mitchell's stuff. Most of this stuff is like really, it's almost like the whole album is like a B-side to her career or something like that. It's like really interesting.
Yeah. And up until today, I'd never heard of this album.
No.
To be honest. Not that I'm, you know, I don't follow Joni Mitchell that closely, but, you know, I had at least heard of Blue and Court and Spark and Hejira and the sort of the classic albums. I'd never heard of this one, though.
Yeah, it's definitely an underground album, despite the fact that it has her last top 10 hit on it. But that top 10 hit gets ignored today in a lot of ways. And I honestly think that, well, I think that top 10 hit might have actually been the weakest song on the whole album.
Well, yeah. It's still a good song, but, you know, yeah, I know what bad. You mean. It's yeah.
It just deserves a lot more attention because it there's a lot of interesting things going on. It's quite experimental, and not that, you know, experimental makes a good album all on its own, but it certainly it rarely detracts. Honestly, most of the time when someone's being experimental, I'm kind of all for it. I guess maybe lots of people out there are like, no, I hate it when people are too experimental. It's off-putting and something like that. But honestly, I respect it personally. It's something that I'm all for.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that brings us to the question, like, would you listen to this again?
Yes. Yes, probably. But like Joni Mitchell's stuff, and this has nothing to do with her. It's me. I have to be in the right mood to listen to her stuff. That's just me. But this is an album that if I'm in the mood for a Joni Mitchell album, I'm likely to pick this again because it's just that interesting to me.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I would absolutely listen to it again. Yeah, you're right. I'm the same way. Like, there are certain artists that I have to be in the mood for. I think Joni Mitchell is one of those for me as well. And yeah, I would absolutely put this on again for sure. So I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. We want to hear from you, whether you agree or disagree with our review of the album. Please let us know. If you can go to the contact page at polyphonicpress.com, and while you're there, you can check out previous episodes and lots of cool stuff like that. And if you feel inclined, you can also help us out by going to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. And there's some cool perks there, like you can get these episodes the day before they're released, and lots of cool stuff there. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.